Accession number 7310, roll number 11.
I think we got as far as Bosch Buster firing in World War II in an anti-invasion role, and then the War Office are awfully keen, ever since the collapse of France, on finishing anything to do with the rear artillery. And when France collapsed, I was sent for and told to close the school down because I think poor things, they were worn to shreds. I remember the officer concerned saying, "What's the good of the rear artillery now? We'll never go to France again," waving his hands in the air. The whole thing was going to be closed down. And it was then that I put certain measures into operation, which resulted in the action by Winston Churchill. Anyway, then came the end of the war, and when I tried to get Bosch Buster out of France to demolish the Atlantic forts, but was prevented from doing it. And then, again, everybody lost interest. I went into music, and had to scrap every remembrance of military things in order to concentrate in my mind the memory of music, which I had to perform, that kind of thing. And then gradually, as the years went by, I can't remember what the connection was, but there seemed to be a mini growing interest in what happened in World War II. It may have been with reference to the guns, I don't know, but I gradually began to wonder what in the end happened to Bosch Buster, whether it might still be alive. And then I found that the Royal Artillery Institution at Woolwich would be quite prepared to accept Bosch Buster, at my suggestion, as a memorial of the greatness of the Royal Artillery in past years, because after all it was the biggest gun ever manned by the Royal Artillery in the field of battle. And so they would rather encourage me to go and see if I could find it, and I spent from 1965 to about 4 or 5 years writing to the papers, getting a lot of help from everybody, from demolition firms and all kinds of people to try and help me trace Bosch Buster. Nobody could. Nobody had any idea what had happened. Shoeburyness thought they might have found a clue in that they had some bogies there, and so I went to look at them and found that they weren't anything to do with the rear artillery. But they did show me an 18-inch barrel which they've been used there, and that's still in existence, for proving RAF bombs or something through it. And that has been, in actual fact, that has been presented to the Royal Artillery when they finished with it at Shoeburyness. But Bosch Buster, what happened? And then I went to Woolwich Arsenal and found in charge of the weaponry there was Brigadier John Lewenden, who was extremely helpful. And he was still serving, and he had the whole of the arsenal under him, And he told me then that they had no railway gardens there, but there had been some there at some time. So he found two Irish men who had been there a long time, and they said, oh yes. And so he very kindly gave me every assistance to find out from them what I could. And they told me a tragic story, how that all the railway gardens were accumulated in Woolwich Arsenal and kept in perfect condition. Boschbaster was one of them, and with the nameplate in bronze on the side, HMG Boschbaster, like an engine, a locomotive plate. All was intact, and it was kept painted and oiled and greased most carefully, as it had always been in its previous incarnation. But he said the day came when nobody had any further use for them. They were in a case in all obsolete, and so there was nothing for it, and nobody wanted them, so they called in the demolition people, and they were all cut up with oxyacetylene flame in 1961. And I didn't discover this till about 1965 or 66. And so the tragedy is there's not a trace of Boschbaster left except two or three little bits and pieces, which I was given to the Royal Institution. So that was the end of Boschbaster. But I would dearly love to think that a really good model could be made of it, or even a mock-up. I don't see why a mock-up couldn't be made, not to work, but to look at, so that the present generation can see the magnitude, because it was a most impressive thing to look at by any on any account. It was massive, and everybody who first, at their first appearance of Boschbaster, stood completely still and gazed at this monster, thinking they'd never seen anything so huge before. So I'm hoping one day that there may be either a mock-up or a jolly good model made of it, a better one than they have in the Imperial War Museum, which isn't truly to scale.
Did you know anything about the German super heavies in the First World War? How they compared with Boschbaster, Scene-Shifter and the like?
Yes, I think the German super heavies in World War One were, on the whole, rather behind. I think they were very much behind the development of the British super heavies of all kinds, the road kinds and the railway kinds. It's possible they may have excelled us in their road howitzers, the 8-inch and other howitzers, but their railway guns didn't really develop until the Paris gun, as it should be called. People quite wrongly call it Big Bertha. It wasn't Big Bertha. Big Bertha was a coast defense gun of a much smaller one. But the Paris gun, as the Germans called it, was an ex-naval gun of about 15 inches or something dimension, which was tubed down to 8 inches and had an extension added to its muzzle, and it was mounted in the forest of Comblain, I can't remember the name, within range of Paris, and it was fired. It was brought into position by railway, lowered to the ground into an enormous pit, and had an enormous mounting made for it, which was assembled. It took months to assemble it and a spell, and then they fired it with a tragic result on Good Friday in 19, I can't remember when it was. And that was the beginning, I think, of the German interest in railway artillery. I don't think they had very much in that way before then. Then it appears that during the interval between the two wars, Krupp got very busy on designing the railway artillery of the future. Of course, when Hitler came to power, all these designs were ready in his blueprints, and he had just had to press the button and off they went, making these very fine railway guns and masses of them as such. Very fine in many ways, but not in some. For instance, they produced a very large number of, to us, very tiresome railway guns. What are they? The K5Es, which were a source of terrible trouble at the landings in Salerno, Italy, and caused a lot of casualties there on the beach, etc. And then the acme of the German effort in World War II was the development of the Paris gun along the same lines. But they made a special gun on this occasion with a very, very, very long barrel, so slender that it had to have a special apparatus to support the muzzle to keep it from drooping, because droop is a thing that was always concerned in artillery design. Because if you had a long, thin gun, which theoretically should projecting a shell at a very long range, extremely long range, and the thinner it was and the longer it was, the longer the range. But this question of droop was a constant worry, because with big guns you had to allow for droop in your calculations. And the Germans got over it by this wonderful mechanism, to their credit, of lifting the muzzle up by that degree of droop, which meant that the whole barrel was perfectly horizontal, perfectly level, when it got into action. And then they did another wonderful thing with this K-12E, which it was. They put it on a mounting which could be jacked up, which was mobile on the road, but it had an enormous train behind it carrying all the platform and things like that. And when it went into action, they laid their own circular track, I should think it was about the size of half a football field. And these railway lines are carried by a mobile train on wagons and lifted down to the ground and laid in a circle with the straight cross going through from the main line to the or the extension of the main line, right across the circle, as it was called. And then when the gun was moved up, it was moved up to the centre of the circle, then it was raised up by hydraulic jacks quite considerably, and they had a special engine detached from the mounting, which is a very good idea, a little way apart, which did all the power, produced the electricity of all kinds. And that raised the gun up to a sufficient height, first of all, to a sufficient height so that you could swivel the bogies round and then lower them down at right angles to the line of the gun and landing on the circle, a circular track. And that meant the gun was completely mobile, and it was it landed itself on some kind of central pivot so that you could swivel it round on this pivot to any angle you liked, around back north, south, east and west, so to speak, on that circle. And that was a wonderful thing, although it did take hours. You had to prepare the ground, first of all, it had to be perfectly level and hard and solid, and there had to be a lot of ballast available, and it took quite a time really to prepare their position. So in that sense it wasn't mobile, but it was mobile in the sense that when you got this gun with a colossal range, with railway mobility, which took only a reasonable time, put it that way, to put it into action. It didn't have to have a concrete fort or bed or anything like that. It could fire anywhere, provided the ground was level.
In the First World War, did they start using big guns before we did, the Germans? Were they using heavier stuff before us?
No, I think we were the first to produce the heavy guns. And I think we're very clever at that, because take, for instance, the 8-inch howitzer with which a 36 siege battery went out in 1915. That was a very quickly devised howitzer, made out of a 6-inch Mark IV, something very old-fashioned, a 6-inch gun, and cut in half, with the top half thrown away, and bored out to take a very modern rifled tube inside, and that became the first 8-inch howitzer, which was far bigger than anything the Germans had.
It was bigger than...
Oh, it was bigger than anything they had then. From that moment, we never looked back. We went on going bigger and bigger and bigger, ending eventually with Bosch Buster. The Germans lagged behind us in World War I, but were streets ahead of us in World War II. They had all their wonderful set of modern equipment, railway gun mountings, beautifully designed. There was only one mistake with the K5Es, because I travelled on one after the war ended, and I was given permission to go out to Germany and explore the situation. And they gave me, on a Sunday morning, they gave me free use of one of these K5s, and I could run it up and down the railway line of the locomotive as much as I liked. And I peered down and I looked at these enormous bogies underneath, and I found that they had, I think I'm right in saying there were 12 wheels to each bogey, six axles. And how on earth they got those axles to go round very severe curves on the railway, it was very skillful, but not practical. I think only the outer wheels had flanges, and the central wheels were flat. And so they skidded on the surface of the ground. I didn't like that. It was much better from my point of view to have the Bosch Buster system, in which we had more bogies than they would have needed. They would have needed more bogies than the K5 than they actually had. They only had four, I think it was. We had four on Bosch Buster, but they only had... Three of them had four axles, and one of them had three axles. And they were very mobile. They could go down around a curve of 750 feet radius. And the German gun was a very clumsy affair so far as mobility was concerned, but it was a very powerful gun, very effective.
How would you say the German technology as a whole compared with ours in the First World War? You know, just keeping to the First World War situation, I'm thinking now of things like motor vehicles at the front and aircraft.
I think I'm almost right in thinking that we were ahead of them. After all, take the extreme case of the tank. It was a complete and utter surprise to the Germans that we ever had devised such a thing as a tank. And they were so shattered when they first appeared on the Somme that all resistance in the German the section of the German front in which they were used collapsed. And the mistake made then was that there was no, as there was no opposition, we were not prepared for that. And why didn't we have our cavalry all ready to take over from the tanks and to wipe the whole thing out? We could have turned the flank of the Germans in no time. But it took us by surprise, the success of the tanks. And we were so ill-prepared that nobody followed them up. The German resistance collapsed, and until they began to shoot at the tanks and destroy them where they were, miles ahead of the former front, British front line, and they had to come back one by one, limping back when they could, and that was an end to the thing. However, you asked about design. I think it was treated ahead, and in our transport, I think it was there were German lorries and we had British lorries. There wasn't much to choose between them. But I think on the whole we were ahead of them. But they were, yes, and when they produced a German tank, it was a laughable effort compared with ours. It was a monstrous failure. They didn't like the idea of our tanks having their revolving things at the side.
The turrets?
Would it be not the turret, no, the things they travelled on.
The tracks.
Tracks.
Yes.
Thank you. They didn't like the idea of the tracks being so exposed, which of course they are still more so in the case of the modern tanks. So they covered all those with armour plating, and the armour plating went right down to the ground, and they made them mobile. They couldn't move over ground. They just sank into it. So they never competed with our tank effort in World War I. But of course they were ahead of us in World War II because they were they'd been preparing for it secretly all those many years when we were not.
How about things like telescopic sights on rifles? Do you think they were... I know their sniping, from what I've heard, was very good the beginning of the war, before ours started. Do you think they were... What would you say about that?
In World War One?
In World War One, yes, keeping to World War One.
Well, I'm not an expert on small arms fire. Or rifles and machine guns and things, but I have a feeling that we were rather sort of equal in that respect. They had their machine guns, we had our Lewis guns, we had our Vickers machine guns as well, and I think they were ahead of us telescopically, in that I think they produced the telescopic sight before we did, and that was a source of great trouble to us, because machine gunning, I remember looking at a German down the barrel of a machine gun from our front line trenches and seeing it pointing straight at me. Well, fortunately they were asleep at the time, otherwise I wouldn't be here to tell the tale. But it was interesting to me, because they could have popped off anybody with machine guns, and they did, unfortunately, because I think their sighting was better than ours in that respect.
Did you ever experience gas warfare?
Yes, in World War One. My first experience was rather tragic, because I had been, I think it may have been in October 1916, out at, as I was throughout the summer, FOO, Forward Observation Officer, and coming back one night after having done my tour of duty at the OP, the conditions in the trenches were simply appalling, because you often had to wade up to above your knees, sometimes right up to your waist, to get anywhere, and it was an awfully slow process. because your feet had nothing to tread on. Even then, it was all slush. And in the process of getting out of that slush and trying to get back to the battery and stumbling over the ground one night, I lost my gas mask and one or two other things. And of course, that was the very night when they chose to use gas. And I remember the smell of it distinctly. It was horrid. And somehow or other, I struggled back. I can't remember how. And I think it may have been on that night that it was so pitch dark that just as I was getting to the battery position, a wretched 9-2, which I couldn't see, it was so dark, went bang off firing, and I was almost in front of it, but just alongside it, and that deafened my left ear, which has been a sort of trouble ever since. But it's all right now, because they can give me aids which help me to hear. But that was the effect of gas, and fortunately it didn't. I think it may have been only lacrimatory gas at that time, but there was a lot of mustard gas about. And we had to be awfully careful. We were constantly having gas mask inspections. But we didn't have to wear our gas masks unless there was a warning that there was gas, unless there was a gas alert, as it was called. But it was very nasty. And the trouble with gas was that it lingered in the ground unless there was a wind to blow it away. It's rather troublesome. But I don't think mustard gas affected the artillery quite as much as it did the infantry, poor things. And they got the worst of it, as they did of most of the trouble.
Did your gas masks improve as the war progressed? Were you given different models?
Yes, I think it did. The first ones are very primitive indeed. And they only had perspex over the glasses, so you couldn't see through them. But they did improve quite a lot. And we ended up the war with a very good gas mask. And I doubt whether the present one could be much improved on it, except perhaps chemically, from the chemical point of view.
How about the use of horses at the front? Were they very much in evidence throughout the First World War, the cavalry?
Horses, of course, everything was a lot of things were drawn by horse transport. All the 18-pounders of those days were drawn by horse transport. And the services were drawn by horse transport. There were ammunition wagons and things like that. And you asked about transport relating to... Oh, cavalry, yes. Cavalry, of course, were entirely mounted on horses. And they were kept very much in the background. And